The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Delighted to be joined by one of our leading novelists, a man who certainly has his finger on the pulse of modern Ireland, and maybe that's a good description, the pulse, given that his new book, his latest novel, is Heart Be at Peace. Donal Ryan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Matt. Pleasure.
This is a companion, is it, to your breakthrough work, The Spinning Heart?
Yeah, it's kind of a standalone sequel, so it definitely can be read.
Sorry, hang on, what do you mean by a standalone sequel?
It means you don't have to have read The Spinning Heart to enjoy it and to follow it.
Okay.
So yeah, so it stands alone, but it's still, it's the same format. It's 21 monologues and the same characters, and it's 10 years after the action in The Spinning Heart.
What brought you back to those characters?
Well, they were kind of always there, and I always had kind of a plan to write a second Spinning Heart because it didn't feel quite finished. It felt as though there was more to be said. And also, I suppose that village where it's set is the same place where nearly all of my fiction was set since. And so characters from Spinning Heart have crossed over into other stories and novels. So it felt quite natural. And also my mum, God rest her, she asked me so many times, would you not just write a sequel to Spinning Heart? Because she was so tired of being asked by her customers in Tesco's about the characters in Spinning Heart. Like, people would say to her, and how's Bobby Mann? Where is he now? You know, as though he was a real person. And so she said, wouldn't it just be handiest now if you just wrote a sequel, people would know. So I'm sorry I didn't do it sooner so she could read it, but it's done now anyway, thank God.
Sorry, how long is she dead?
She died last year.
Oh, sorry about that.
Spring, yeah.
How's that been with you?
Sure, I suppose, you know, it's a new world when your mum passes away, but I suppose it comes to us all, so it's tough, all right, yeah.
And has that influenced your writing?
I think so, actually, yeah. I did, you know, my last novel, The Queen of North Ireland, was written for Mam. It was about Mam, even though she didn't see it, but she didn't see herself in it. She couldn't figure out where I got you, what I lived from. But this novel was written, yeah, I suppose, kind of in the wake of losing her, and I suppose it's kind of a tribute to her. I went easy on the bad language because she was never too fond of that in my books. She wasn't too backward about using bad language, but she didn't like it in my books at all.
So Spinning Heart was really the sort of the great post-recession novel. So have you moved on now?
I suppose, yeah. Like, I never intended that to happen. Like, it's just because I set Spinning Heart in contemporary Ireland in 2010 when I wrote it, there was no way of avoiding the recession. Just as like with the new book, there's no way of avoiding the current issues of the day. And I mean, it's still there. Like, people still, it's not as though Ireland is fixed and the economy is perfect, but people still feel the effects. But I do tend, when you're writing something that's set in the present day, I suppose you have to include some element of people's reactions to what's going on in the world. But I am not that political, or, you know, I haven't a great grasp of economics. So it's not, and it's not really my job to do.
It's how it impacts on people's day-to-day lives,
yeah,
isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
And how they see the things that maybe others are supposed to be dealing with. But actually, the phrase others, is this a big thing that actually is really sort of happening in Irish society and in rural Irish society at present, that there's a degree of othering coming in? And you're from Tipperary, and I suppose what we would have seen this year in Tipperary is the reaction in Ross Cray to the refugees being placed in a local hotel. So that sort of thing, is that the sort of reaction to that also a reaction to other things and change going on in society that people are struggling with?
Of course. I mean, you can understand how change is terrifying, and very sudden, very dramatic change to any place is going to be terrifying for the people who are there. So you can understand people's fear and frustration. And if people aren't consulted at all, and all of a sudden their landscape and the society they occupy changes drastically. I mean, you can't expect people just to say fine, you know. So, I mean, so I think peaceful protest is always going to, is something that people should be available to them. But of course, it should never, ever, ever turn nasty. And, you know, and or be directed at individuals. It's a very complex issue.
Because you've been sympathetic to minorities in your writing in the past. I'm thinking you had a Syrian refugee, didn't you, in one of
That's
your
right,
books
yeah,
as well. And you had a traveller, character as well. So you've actually an understanding and a sympathy for those people who come from those who might be othered by people.
Absolutely. But I mean, you know, the likes of traveller characters, I mean, they were never, for me, they were never others, because growing up, there were travellers in my class in school, there were my neighbours and friends. And same with people from
Syria.
That's
not the way for everybody in Ireland, though.
Actually, and I was so surprised about that, actually. I remember asking somebody at the time who read an early copy of the book, who was involved in publishing, a good friend. And I said, do you think I got the voice right, traveller voice? And he said, I've never spoken to a traveller. And I couldn't believe it. I was thinking, sure, I suppose that's the case. If you're from D4 or whatever, like, you're not going to have encounters travellers, probably. But, you know, for me, that was a really alien concept. But that's just going back to my idiocy. Like, I tend to go around the world with my eyes closed and have them open.
You could rudely. Not go around with your eyes closed, given that you chronicle so many things that are going on in this country. You couldn't possibly.
Yeah, but I mean,
you're sucking up everything.
No, but that's
presumably.
The thing. I always said that. I'm always shocked into awareness. And I think that shock kind of has a profound effect, and it allows me to feel things deeply and to transmute them into fiction, luckily for me. But, you know, I mean, I find things out all the time that people knew for years, and I go, oh my God. And then I think very deeply about the thing. And so I give myself the job then of making fiction out of it, because that's the strange paradox about fiction. It, you know, making stuff up makes things feel more real.
How much fun, though, is it to go back to characters and develop them more than a decade on from what you'd written about previously?
Oh God, I really enjoyed it. I really did. And it felt as though they were just waiting there. Like, just one character in particular, Kate, and it felt as though she was waiting just to say, oh God, what took you so long? You know, and all this stuff happened to me and I was waiting so long to tell you. You know, and I know this didn't happen, but it felt as though the character was in my head dictating and I was just writing it down. It was great. You know, it didn't feel at all as though I was making it up. I wasn't going, like, what could she say next? What could have happened to her? What could the story be? It just felt as though the story was there and I just had to tap in.
Yeah, but how difficult is it to do 21 different characters, to get into the voices and the heads of 21 different imaginary people?
Well, it didn't feel hard, because I remember years ago writing Spinning Heart, I thought to myself, if I tell myself it's hard, if I allow myself to start believing this is hard, it'll start to be hard. You know, because the first few monologues wrote themselves, and I thought, if I just stay in the mindset and don't overthink it, it'll stay happening, you know. And I think because at the time I was so busy, we had just had a baby and I had a new job, I was working very long hours and weekends, and I thought, if I start thinking too much, I'll ruin it, you know. And I've done that. I've made that mistake over and over again over the years. I've overthought things and started to get too complex and gone off on weird tangents, so it's good to keep it simple.
Is Anne-Marie still doing the most important thing, which is reading your work in progress and critiquing and analysing it?
She is, thank God, because I'm so lucky. Like, it really is a blessing, because she has such a great eye. She's such a great reader. She's got a very natural skill for editing, you know, and kind of broad stroke editing. Like, she'll say it was no good or it is, you know, and I know.
Was she good at sort of spotting the connection between the Spinning Heart and the way the characters were there and the way they are now in your new novel?
Yeah. Like, the main thing I asked of Anne-Marie when I was writing the first draft of Heartbeat Peace was whether it felt right, whether the character still felt true. And for the most part, she said, yes, thank God, you know. And so it's great to have that. Not everyone does.
For the most part, when does she disagree? And how does she disagree with you? And do you find it sort of damaging to your ego if she tells you you're doing this wrong?
No, she's gotten really good at it. It's really subtle. So I have to pick up on the subtle indicators that it's not quite right. So it's something in her expression or her bearing, you know, a certain tone she'll use. Well, no. So we won't have to have too much conversation about it.
But how do you react then? Do you get disappointed or do you get frustrated?
No, I get disappointed. I used to sulk a bit, but I don't anymore, because I know everything's fixable. You know, there's nothing, I can never go too far wrong. So no matter what happens, who cares anyway? You know, it's just writing. A day's writing isn't that big a deal. You can just start again the next day and get it right. So there's no panic in throwing things away, restarting. And also, nothing's ever wasted. I mean, I've written whole novels that won't get published, but the act of writing them was a huge learning curve, so nothing's wasted.
Okay, I should have started where I'm going to ask you now, but tell us the story in Heart Be at Peace.
Well, it goes back to the characters in The Spinning Heart. So Bobby Mahon is still a central figure, and he's very much looked up to in his small rural community. And Bobby has kind of assigned himself the job of sorting out the drugs issue in the area. Now, and that's an impossible task. There's no way he's going to do it. But Bobby feels this terrible pressure as a man and as a parent because he knows his children are in danger from local drug dealers. And it's a universal story. I mean, it's not just Ireland or rural Ireland or urban Ireland. It's everywhere in the world. I think every community in the world is affected in some way by hard drugs and the proliferation of drug dealing. And the fact that it seems sometimes as though the people doing it have impunity. You know, you can, I don't know how many times today, just around Dublin, I saw drugs being dealt. You know, in my in Limerick, the other day, I saw drugs being dealt. It's incredible. And, you know, and it's a real imminent danger for young people. So Bobby has this thing in his head that he has to sort it out. And he's kind of trying to rally his friends and his colleagues to the cause. And so there's a conflagratory kind of ending to this, to Bobby's efforts.
You mentioned that you saw open dealing taking place today as you're going around Dublin, that you saw it recently in Limerick, that there would perhaps be a perception, or there used to be a perception nationally, that these were urban issues. But how much has Ireland changed, even since the time that you wrote The Spinning Heart, where yes, there would have been drug use and drug abuse in rural Ireland, but that it's becoming more prevalent, and particularly with the use of things like cocaine?
Absolutely. There just seems to be absolutely no supply issue at all. Like, they must have the best supply chain system in the world, these guys. You know, the ability to get drugs from wherever they're made to people's front doors is just apparently incredible. You know, and we know this, like, but I suppose, I mean, maybe social media and WhatsApp and stuff and you know, people have the resources, that people have the means now to communicate much more easily, much more secretly.
But why do you think it is in the Irish psyche that we are still, we are turning to these drugs when there seems to be less of a dependence than there would have been on alcohol, which is something that writers over the decades and centuries in Ireland would have written about, the Irish love for the bitter drink. And that yet we have people who are far more health conscious and younger generations who are far more conscious of fitness and of aesthetics. And yet they turn now to drugs which are arguably even more dangerous than alcohol.
I suppose it goes back. It's like the, you know, the lesson we were taught in secondary school over and over again in civics class. You'll be offered a free sample and you'll take that and you'll get hooked. Like, we were always told that in school, you know, that's how drug dealers operate. And I suppose that must be it, you know. And apparently people who take cocaine really enjoy it the first time. So I've heard. I wouldn't know, honestly, but people, that this is what I'm told. It's highly addictive, obviously. So that's the way it goes, I suppose. You know, you get hooked and that's it. You're in the net and you keep paying out. I mean, I've heard horror stories about people being visited, people's families being visited, and their homes being ransacked, and people who have lost their lives to drugs being told, but you still owe the money, they still have a drug debt. And these drug debts increasing exponentially, you know, and people being told, well, you have no choice, you have to pay them, you know. And this is what gets me, that these guys walk around and we're all supposed to be scared of them. You know, and as a society, we're supposed to allow them the space. And they are allowed the space, you know, and it's very hard on the guards. I mean, it's, you know, you can't look sideways at people these days. So it's, you know, it's tough. It's hard to know what to do, like what's going to happen.
Okay, look, I have come out of time. You are going to be talking to Alex Clark, I believe, in the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary tomorrow week.
That's right.
Thursday the 15th. There are tickets available at paviliontheatre.ie. I'm sure you've whetted the appetite now for many people. And
hopefully.
The book, Heart Be at Peace, is available in the shops from tomorrow, I believe.
That's right, yeah.
Congratulations.
Thanks
and
so much,
another
Matt.
Great book. Donal Ryan, thank you so much for being with us.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today.